Numerical analysis, namely the stability of finite differencing schemes. We'll say a little bit about that, and then we'll go on to talk about the spherically symmetric collapse of Einstein massless Klein-Gordon system, and that will do it for me for the week. And then this afternoon, you can continue to work on the project, first project. All right, so it's a fact that when you're dealing with finite difference time-dependent partial differential equations and converting them into some sort of a discrete form, and so marching things forward in time, that quite often things blow up on you. And you know, this can be understood in a relatively straightforward way, and so although we won't be able to spend too much time in this course discussing it, it's so important from the point of view of time-dependent equations that we really need to spend a little bit of time looking at the basic ideas. So, the first observation is that blow-ups can be sometimes caused by what I would call legitimate bugs. That is, things that you've incorrectly implemented. In other words, you take a system of partial differential equations, you introduce some sort of finite differencing, but either you finite difference things incorrectly, or in your implementation, going from pen and paper to computer code, something screwed up, and this can lead to a blow up. So in that case, presumably if you can find the bug and fix things up, then you can go on and compute and things won't blow up. However, there are other times when the finite difference scheme itself can lead to instability, and that's what we want to consider here. So we want to consider this notion of stability of solutions of difference equations, and once again, we're going to consider the 1D wave equation. So second partial time of u is equal second partial space. So this is a linear, non-dispersive wave equation. That is, if we do a Fourier mode analysis independent of the wavelength, or equivalently the frequency of the mode, the propagation speed of that mode is unity in the units that we've chosen. So, because it's linear and because it's non-dispersive, not necessarily because it's non-dispersive, another feature is that the size of the solution does not change with time. So, schematically then, denoting a norm of the solution, some sort of measure, like an integral of the square of the solution over the domain, we expect the solution at any given time to be approximately at least the same size as the solution at the initial time. So here's a suitable norm, take the function, square it, integrate it over the spatial domain, and then take the square root. And what one will mean by stability in a problem will often depend from the problem to problem. So if there is the possibility of blow up or of solutions starting with relatively small initial data and then getting very large and then getting very small, then you need to be careful about how you're going to define whether there's something going on, because you have to admit the possibility that the physics may dictate a significant change in the scale of the system during evolution. But typically for wave-type problems, this isn't the case, except possibly for the cases where initial data is fine-tuned. You'll tend to find that the norm of the solution will be sort of constant over time. So we'll use that property that the norm is basically conserved in time as a working definition of stability. We're not going to be very precise. We won't need to be so. So if you believe that's true for the wave equation, then I'll claim then you believe the wave equation is stable. And then for a finite difference approximation, essentially we want to have the same sort of behavior, so that the size of the solution at the nth time step should be roughly the same size as the solution at the initial time. So, remember that the way we generate one of these time-dependent finite difference solutions is by iterating in time. So we start with, for the case of the original wave equation finite difference formula that we wrote down, we start with initial values at two discrete times, t equals zero and t equals delta t, and then we successively generate the second time step, third time step, fourth time step, etc., using this finite difference equation that gives us the values at n plus 1 in terms of values at n and n minus 1. Okay, so, and this is common essentially to any discretization applied to any time-dependent partial differential equation or system of those equations. once you figure out how to go from one discrete time step to another, you know, this process is just iterated. And so it's that iteration itself that one needs to consider when one's considering the stability properties. Okay, so for that scheme, one key observation is you're not guaranteed that the norm will remain roughly constant in time for all values of lambda, okay, where lambda is the ratio of the time step to the space step. In particular, for certain lambda, you'll find, and you can, this was what I was going to show you in the animations, you can look at them, or you can generate them by yourself just by setting certain parameters, the lambda parameter in the codes that you've been playing with to sufficiently large values, you'll see that the solutions actually blow up quite dramatically and quite quickly. So for those values of lambda above a certain threshold, then you find that the norm at some, you know, constant number of iterations diverges from the solution U, even as H goes to zero. And in fact, for the kind of instability that we'll talk about, the instability gets worse and worse in terms of how fast the blow up is in physical time as the mesh spacing goes to zero. And that means that the different scheme is unstable and therefore basically useless for use in practice, at least with that value of the parameter. So the wave equation, the discretization I repeated back here, the standard form is still, you can still use it for certain values of lambda, but above a certain threshold, it becomes unusable. There are other schemes that you can write down which are never usable, that basically for all values of the parameters that appear, they're always unstable. Okay, so, you know, this is something that you really have to keep in mind, that for time-dependent equations, you will not always be guaranteed stability. And in fact, probably the rule is that you'll encounter many more unstable schemes than stable schemes, you know, if you just sort of choose randomly amongst the possible discretization for the various operators that you have. Now, I've already mentioned this, but stability is extremely important from the point of view of solving partial differential equations through finite difference techniques, because for many wave problems, including all linear problems, given that a finite difference scheme is consistent, so the truncation error goes to zero as the spacing goes to zero, then stability is a necessary and sufficient condition for convergence. In other words, these concepts are exactly equivalent. You can't have a convergent different scheme if it's not stable, and similarly, a different scheme can't be stable if it's not convergent. And this is known as Lax's theorem. So what we're going to do to sort of understand, yes, Aaron. Sorry? Tau hat, it's probably a little bit of new notation. It's just the truncation error. Okay, so I think it's tau H before. No, the hat doesn't really mean anything. So in order to understand at least heuristically what's going on, let's write a general time-dependent finite difference approximation in the following form. We'll introduce a new vector of unknowns, and I'm suppressing the spatial grid here. I'm just referring to what's happening in time. So U will be a vector of unknowns introduced so that I can write the finite difference approximation as a two-step scheme. So in other words, I can then write the advanced values of U simply as some operator acting on the retarded values. So there's only two steps that comes into this. And in order to do that, it's exactly the same technique that we used in order to reduce a second order in time partial differential equation into one which is first order in time. We just introduce auxiliary variables, which are the time derivatives. So here, the auxiliary variables were introduced essentially to if you have three levels, then you introduce a new scheme, a new discrete unknown, in this case, Vj, right, which is, oh, man. Never. So in the formula, we have, again, going back to that formula. So the advanced value, that's not the one I wanted. The advanced value of u depends on the n values plus the n minus 1, so we want to convert this to something at time step n. And to do that, we just define this new variable vnj to be un minus 1j. So we double the number of variables. So we have the u's and v's now, but now we can write that original difference equation in this form. So ujn plus 1 is the same thing. I've just replaced un minus 1j by this. And of course, the update for v then is simply that vn plus 1j is equal to unj. So now I've got the system in this form, where the next time step depends only on data at the current time step. And once more, you can do that for any system of time-dependent partial differential equations. It's just a case of getting things into this canonical form so that we don't have to worry about all of the different nuances of different kinds of equations. And I'll repeat that this, I'm not doing anything rigorously here. It's essentially just to give you an idea of what's going on with stability analysis. Okay, so once we have that, then this notion that we get to time from time step to time step just by applying this operator G provides a very compact way of describing the finite difference solution. So if we have initial data u0, then after n time steps, we will have the solution u at discrete time tn is simply what we get by taking the operator g, multiplying by itself n times, that is, taking the nth power of that and applying it to the initial data. So now what we need to do is understand what the spectrum of g is, because stability will then be controlled by the spectrum of g. So for simplicity and for sake of discussion, we're going to assume that g has a complete set of orthonormal eigenvectors. So ek, k runs from 1 to j, so that's the number of the total number of components in the solution, not necessarily the number of spatial steps anymore, or the size of the grid, because we've doubled the number of variables. And there'll be corresponding eigenvalues, mu sub k, again, k going over the number of the size of that vector u. So given that, then, we have, of course, that g acting on ek is equal to mu k times ek, just by the definition of eigenvalue and eigenvector, so that we can do a spectral decomposition of the initial data, so we can write the initial vector u0 in terms of a sum over the basis vectors, ek, the eigenvectors, orthonormalized eigenvectors, where these ck0 are now coefficients. Okay? That you can compute by taking the inner product of u0 with each of the ek. So then the solution at time step n is simply given again by taking the matrix G, raising it to the nth power, applying that to the expansion. And so all we get is the original expansion coefficients and then the eigenvalues raised to the nth power. Yeah, Aaron. Well, we'll get to that just in a second. Okay. So the key thing here is then that the what appears after n iterations is the eigenvalues raised to the nth power. Okay. So if the difference scheme is to be stable, then we have to have the magnitude of those eigenvalues, which in general can be complex, have to be less than or equal to 1. Okay? So geometrically, then, the eigenvalues of this update matrix G have to lie on or within the unit circle. Otherwise, the difference scheme will be unstable and the different solutions will generically blow up. Okay? So again, just schematically, here's an illustration of a location in the complex plane with some putative eigenvalues for this update matrix G. And in this case, they're all lying on or within the unit circle, so at least superficially, this finite difference scheme could be stable. Right? You could still get an instability even if the eigenvalues are lying on the unit circle, especially for nonlinear problems, but we'll sort of ignore that issue right now. The other way around, if any of these eigenvalues are outside the unit circle, though, of course, you will definitely get an instability. So that we can't have.
inside the unit circle, though, mean that the solutions are going to tend to some
damp? Absolutely. Those particular components, if there's any components, any eigenvalues corresponding to eigenvectors, and those eigenvalues have norm less than unity, then those components of the solution will tend to damp. So there's a slightly more formal version of this that von Neumann introduced in the 40s and the 50s. So it's basically a Fourier analysis, and it's based on these ideas. Okay, so in order to do the Fourier analysis, we assume that the difference equation is linear with constant coefficients. If it's not, we linearize and we freeze coefficients, and we sort of assume that we can apply the Fourier analysis at every spatial point, and that it makes sense, and that we have periodic boundary conditions. Okay. Now, this is a bit of an assumption, because in general we won't have periodic boundary conditions, and the problems won't be linear, but the rationalization is that instability is usually a high-frequency phenomena. Okay, low frequencies, that is, components of the solution which are smooth with respect to the mesh scale, it tends to be relatively easy to get stability. That just sort of follows from the consistency of the finite difference scheme. Things tend to go wrong, and it's not a hard and fast rule, but they do tend to go wrong at large wave numbers. And in that case, these approximations, that the boundary conditions really don't matter, make sense, because then what you're really interested in is what's happening locally, you know, say over a few wavelengths. Okay? So we're going to assume that, and then we're going to use Fourier analysis, or one goes ahead and uses Fourier analysis, and I'm not going to do any of it here, but what you find is that the same thing happens. You get the same sort of simplification happening for the finite difference operators. Ben, maybe you're going to have to come up here and continuously move the mouse. Well, I don't know. It's not the screensaver, right? So
maybe there's a corner of the screen where you can put the mouse.
Is it? Is it?
It's been moving the mouse. Maybe one of the corners. What I'm guessing is that the mouse cord is tangled around video cord in a way that moving the mouse will.
Yeah, but I'm not sure why it's cutting out. Anyway, we'll see how it goes.
I think there's gremlins.
Yeah, I think there's gremlins too. So we're not going to do any of that. So the difference operators will translate to algebraic operations in the Fourier variable K, just as they translate to algebraic operations when you apply them to the spatial derivatives. And when one applies this von Neumann analysis to the wave equation, one finds that the value of this parameter lambda has to be less than or equal to 1 for stability. And that condition is often called the CFL condition, after Courant, Friedrichs, and Levy, who derived it in 1928. Again, they were looking at these finite difference schemes as a way of establishing existence and uniqueness of the continuum partial differential equations. And it has this rather nice interpretation. That, let's again sketch our domain here. So we have x running this way, we have t running this way, and let me draw a couple of finite difference meshes. So in this case, we have delta t is greater than delta x. In this case, we have delta t is less than delta x. And if we assume that we have these, well, for this scheme, we have this communication pattern. And so at the advanced time step, We start with unknown here, start with, this is n minus 1, n, and we're getting this unknown here. Basically, the information can communicate with the nearest neighbors, and that's it. And so from time step to time step, we have this notion of a numerical late cone. I should draw one more row here. Actually, I need one. So if I start with a disturbance here, then numerically, it spreads out like this. Okay, so that's the computational light cone. Over here, the computational light cone similarly looks like this. But now let's consider the physical light cone. The physical light cone is basically given by something with 45-degree slope. So it looks like this. And here it looks like this. Okay. So in this case, the computational light cone contains the physical light cone. But in this case, it doesn't. So here, the computation can't possibly account for all the information that needs to propagate, and therefore the scheme is unstable. So that's the basic interpretation of that kind of instability. Okay? And in fact, that's an absolutely necessary condition for convergence of any finite difference scheme, is that this computational cone has to contain the physical cone, or else there's just no way that the scheme will converge. And that's essentially one of the things that was worked out in this 1928 paper. Okay? Now, when people learn a little bit about instability theory, they tend to latch on to this notion that this you have this physical interpretation for this instability, and especially with physicists, they tend to try to look around for rationalizations of why things are unstable. It's certainly, in my opinion, at least not always the case that you're going to be able to understand an instability from sort of a physical point of view, or that it's really, you know, worth your while trying to do it. A lot of cases, it'll just, you know, be an instance that the update matrix, for whatever reason, often because of the way you're treating boundaries, will turn out to have eigenvalues which lie outside the unit circle, and you just have to do something in order to fix that up. Generally change your different scheme, or you can try explicitly adding dissipation. And this is something that you're instructed to do in the current project, because what that does is, if you have a scheme, and if you take something like the wave equation or any other partial differential equation that's derived or drivable from a Hamiltonian or a Lagrangian, then it will tend to be energy conserving. You will tend to end up with eigenvalues that lie on the unit circle if you apply sort of centered Prandtl-Nicholson type schemes, for example. And then when you get into the nonlinear regime, those eigenvalues can really be problematic. You can tend to get instabilities. And so what you'd like to do is just pull them in slightly inside the unit circle, not so much that you end up dissipating too much of the solution, but by making the solution explicitly dissipative. Okay, and that's a technique which often works very well when you're solving these equations, especially in the nonlinear case.
Sorry.
Yeah?
But if you're adding dissipation, are there additional conditions for the Courant?
If you add dissipation, there'll generally be additional conditions on the amount of dissipation you can add before you start triggering new instabilities. But in most cases, if you have a Courant limit, then the addition of dissipation of the type that we advocate, you know, won't really be an impact on your ability to calculate. Okay. Okay. I think I'm going to have to. You have to put it back in. Okay. So let's go back. To the Einstein-Klein-Gordon system. Okay, let's just remind ourselves where we were last day when we finished up. So we derived or rewritten the Klein-Gordon, massless Klein-Gordon equation for the scalar field in terms of these auxiliary variables, where uppercase phi, again, was the spatial derivative. Remember that we're working in a spherically symmetric coordinate system, so this is a radial derivative, and pi, well, here's the definition of pi up here. It involves both the time derivative and the space derivative, the shift vector, and the radial metric function and the Laplace function. So that followed from the definition here, and the dynamical equation then was given here. So time derivative of pi was this expression. And now we just want to take a second to look at the characteristic structure, to look at the actual characteristics of the scalar field. So we have things in a first-order form. They're quasi-linear equations, meaning they're linear in the first derivatives, the highest derivatives, which are appearing on the right-hand side. And so we can write that system by introducing this column vector phi pi in the form ut plus aux is equal to something on the right-hand side b, where b doesn't involve derivatives, spatial derivatives of u. And this matrix A is given by this form. There's an overall minus sign. Beta's on the diagonal. And there's a sign miss. No, that's right. Alpha over A on the off-diagonal terms. Okay. So for a general system of time-dependent equations, this is how you'd go about analyzing the characteristic structure. Luis will have a bit more to say about that next week when he starts talking about the equations of hydrodynamics. So the idea is to write things down so that you identify this matrix that pre-multiplies the first derivatives. And then the characteristic directions, tau, defined to be dr dt of the set, the system, are given by this determinant condition. So we take the matrix, we subtract tau times the identity, we take the determinant of that, and we set that equal to zero. So if you do that, what you find is that tau is equal to minus beta plus or minus alpha over A. So having adopted this 3 plus 1 view in spherical symmetry for spherically symmetric spacetimes, then these essentially are the local speeds of light in that particular coordinate system. Okay? So thinking back to flat spacetime again, beta is equal to 0, alpha over A are equal to 1, both of them. Alpha and A are both 1, so alpha over A is also 1, you would have speeds of plus and minus 1. But in a general 3 plus 1 coordinate system, you know, these speeds could be quite different. And in fact, if you look at this for a little while, you could see, for example, in particular coordinate systems, especially if the shift vector gets large, you can actually have both of the characteristic speeds being negative, for example. Or you can have a characteristic speed being 0. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that in real space, in fact, it's definitely not the case that the light wave, the light ray that's associated with that scalar field, or the scalar field itself, isn't propagating at the speed of light. It just means that your coordinate system is such that the coordinates effectively are moving along with the speed of light as well. Okay, so these are the local signal speeds for the scalar field. So an alternate way of deriving that is simply to take the line element, which is minus alpha squared dt squared plus a squared dr plus beta dt squared, ignoring the angular part because we want to get a condition on dr by dt, set that equal to 0, and solve the quadratic for dr by dt, and you'll get exactly the same result. Now, because we're working in spherical symmetry, we have to be a little bit careful at the singular point in the coordinate system, that is, at r equal to 0. I'm not going to say anything here about that because it won't play into, you don't have to worry about that in your project, because r equals 0 is essentially cut out from the computational domain. But it's something you have to bear in mind, that you often have to take special care in the vicinity of coordinate singularities when you're solving finite difference equations in curvilinear coordinates. But we won't say anything else about that right now. Basically, for the scalar field, he says, now saying something about it, for the scalar field, it amounts to functions will either have even or odd expansions in powers of r as you go to r equal to 0. And from that, you'll be able to determine proper conditions. What I do want to talk a little bit about before sort of wrapping things up are notion of trapped surfaces and apparent horizons. Because one of the things that we're most interested in numerical relativity is gravitational collapse, the formation of black holes. And when you're working computationally, at some point, when you're treating collapse and you're looking for black holes, you want to be able to detect when a black hole has likely formed. The problem with trying to detect black holes, period, in a calculation, are the black holes are very much global objects defined in the space-time. The rigorous definition of a black hole says you have to consider the place where old light rays go to die, which is future null infinity. So you go out to future null infinity, and you have to consider the whole space-time, and then you say, all right, I'm out of future null infinity, now let me consider every event in the space-time which can communicate with me. In other words, every event in space-time from which a light signal can eventually escape to arbitrarily large distances along the light cone. Okay, so that's called the past of future null infinity. For Minkowski space-time, what's the past of future null infinity? Everything. Okay? If, in considering the past of future null infinity, you find boundaries, those are surfaces of black holes. Okay? And then if you take the complement of the space-time and the past of future null infinity, you get the interiors of black holes. Okay, but clearly, in order to define that, I need to have the whole space-time. And that's, you know, so if I'm chunking along, constructing the space-time slice by slice, I'm just not going to be able to say, oh, there's a black hole here. Okay? However, there's this concept which sort of nicely captures at least our intuitive idea of the conditions under which we expect black holes to form, and it's known as an apparent horizon, and it's a form of so-called trapped surface. So the idea is this. You consider, we're in spherical symmetry, but this can, of course, be generalized. So we consider a surface at some constant time and at some constant radius. So that's a two-sphere. Okay? And then we imagine that we cover that two-sphere with flash cubes. Do you guys know what flash cubes are? Yeah, I guess that's the phase transition of kids are so young now. You don't remember the cameras used to have these disposable little cubes that you put on, and then when you took a picture, they'd flash once, and that was it, right? So there was no built-in electronic flashes. We actually had to buy these flash cubes. So anyway, forget about the flash cube. Imagine you've got digital cameras all the way around this two surface, and they're synchronized so that when you press a button, they all go off on this sphere. And it's not really, you see, with flash cube, you can imagine it being isotropic, but with a digital camera, it only projects in one direction. So the thing is, you have to imagine this little flash of light going off in all directions. And so you basically get two waveforms then. You get one that's going out, and you get one that's going in, right? And you can tell that one's going out by looking at its proper surface area as a function of time, and it will be increasing. And you can tell that the other one is going in because you look at its proper surface area as a function of time, and at least for some amount of time, it will be decreasing. Okay? Now, a trapped surface is one on which for both characteristics, the proper surface area is a decreasing function, okay? And that's what happens when you have sufficiently strong gravitational fields, and hence the name trapped, because the outgoing light rays, although they're still locally going out, they're going in an opposite direction to the ingoing ones, they're not going anywhere in sort of overall physical space. You know, their locus is also being contracted. And if you think about what's going to happen then clearly that would suggest that eventually everything is going, those light rays will sort of get compressed down into sort of an arbitrarily small volume of space. And in fact, that's what happens. And that's why, in a very loose sense, you end up with a singularity inside a gravitational field. Also, assuming that you have positive energy, once a region has become trapped, it can't become, you can't untrap it. So if you have some sort of a region and matter falls into it, then all that can happen is it becomes more and more trapped. Okay, so that's the basic idea of a trapped surface, and that notion can be defined and is defined at a single instant of time. Okay? So this is, if you will, an instantaneous approximation to a black hole in any hypersurface. Just to repeat what I said, a trapped surface is a two-surface. It has to have, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, topology S2. And the way that we figure out what the area is doing is by looking at the divergence of the null geodesics coming from that surface. And if the divergence of the outgoing null geodesics is less than zero, that means that locus has a decreasing area as a function of time. So again, the divergence, we just consider some congruence of null rays, apply the gradient operator to it, and take the trace. That gives us the divergence. We'll work through the details in a second. So a marginally trapped surface is one on which the divergence is precisely equal to zero, right? So in some sense, the light rays are just hovering at constant radius, okay? So the idea is this. You consider a space-like surface. You find all the trapped surfaces, then you find all the marginally trapped surfaces, and then you look for the outermost marginally trapped surface, and that's going to be your apparent horizon. Okay? So it's sort of the S2 that encloses the largest volume and whose surface is characterized by the fact that the null geodesics emanating from it have zero divergence. And then if you assume cosmic censorship so that there's no naked singularities, then if you have an apparent horizon, you have an event horizon. However, in a particular calculation, you can certainly have an event horizon before, or your slice can intersect an event horizon before it intersects an apparent horizon. And that's also reasonably easy to understand. So here's a space-time diagram again, spherical symmetry. Here we have a massive star collapsing, for example, or a scalar field collapsing down to form a black hole and a singularity some point here. And once we compute the solution, we find that there's an event horizon, and it's denoted here by this dashed line, okay? So the thing is that in this intermediate time before the apparent horizon forms, we have this region of space-time where there are no trapped surfaces yet, right? So in some sense, it seems like a null geodesic that's emitted will be able to escape to future null infinity. But because of the collapse process, there's additional focusing to the future that you couldn't possibly know about at that time because, you know, you can't see into the future. And so that this null geodesic, which was ostensibly escaping to large distances, actually turns around and eventually hits the singularity. And so then at some later time, you'll find a surface on which the divergence of the null geodesics vanishes, and that will be your apparent horizon. And they generally pop into existence at some sort of finite radius, okay? Whereas the event horizon in this case, you can show, will have to start from r equals zero, all right? So Basically, the apparent horizon then is a sufficient condition for having an event horizon if you assume that there's no naked singularities, but it's not necessary. People tend to use the terms apparent horizon and trapped surface and marginally trapped surface sort of interchangeably in numerical relativity. They're almost always talking, they're concerned with the outermost marginally trapped surface, but they'll often just refer to it as a trapped surface. So let's just work out how we find one of those in spherical symmetry. So we consider a two-surface with some outgoing null tangent. We'll call that UA, and we'll assume that the surface is marginally trapped. Then the divergence of UA is equal to zero. So this, again, this is a space-time covariant derivative operator. Now, UA is a null vector, so we can write it in terms of our usual unit future-directed normal to the t equals constant surfaces, NA, and the unit outwards-pointing space-like normal to that two-surface. So that's SA. Okay, and that gives us that outgoing null vector. So we're now considering a space-time. We've got a t equals constant slice that induced the metric that we call gamma in the three-dimensional surface. Within that three-dimensional surface, we now have a two-surface. The same deal applies. That embedding defines a metric on the two-surface, and we can define a projection operator onto that metric. And that projection operator, which I'm calling here H, so that's probably not the same H you saw before, but HAB is gamma AB. So remember, this is now the metric on the t equals constant surfaces, on the hypersurfaces. And now to construct a projection operator onto the two-surfaces, we use a minus sign because everything is spatial here, so minus SASB. That will project from the four-dimensional space-time onto the two-surface. And so replacing the definition of gamma, replacing gamma AB by its definition in terms of the four-dimensional space-time metric and the unit normal, we have this. Okay, so in exactly the same way that you can show, although we didn't, that KAB, the extrinsic curvature tensor, is defined intrinsically to a hypersurface and therefore doesn't depend on how that hypersurface varies away from it. So you can imagine different slicings which coincide at one instant but which have different continuations to the past and the future. And you might say, well, if I do that, does that change what the extrinsic curvature is? And the answer is no. And so the same thing applies here. If you consider one of these S2s, then you can show that the divergence of UA really is defined on that S2. It doesn't matter how I continue that embedding within the four-dimensional space-time or within the three-dimensional hypersurface. So that's a two-tensor. It's intrinsic to the two-surface, and it doesn't depend on how the two surfaces embedded in sigma, and that helps us with the calculation. So basically, the steps here then, so we write that in terms of the four metric contracted over the gradient of UB, okay, and then immediately we have that's HAB, it's the projection of this because of this property. It doesn't depend on how two surfaces embedded, and therefore we can just apply this operator to that expression. Expanding out what UB is in terms of the spatial derivative, so in terms of the radial unit vector and the time unit vector written in downstairs form. Again, HAB projects onto the two surface. So we can first project onto the three surface, so we insert the usual projection operator onto the surfaces here. And then this acting on grad ASB gives us a three-dimensional gradient acting on SB, and then we have the projection of grad ANB. This is symmetric, so what we pick up from here is simply minus, the anti-symmetric part of this vanishes, the symmetric part of this is simply minus the extrinsic curvature tensor. So we get a minus here, but the extrinsic curvature tensor. And then we replace HAB by GAB minus SASB, the terms involving NA and NB we don't have to put in because they all vanish. And then we work everything out here, and this is our final expression. We use this relation that we can write SB DA SB as 1 half DA SB SB is 1 half DA of 1 is equal to 0. We get the divergence, the free divergence of S minus the trace of the extrinsic curvature plus KAB dotted into two copies of SA SB has to be equal to 0. So that's our equation for a trapped surface. And what we can do now in order to convert this to an expression that can be used when doing actual calculations in a coordinate system is simply replace all these indices, A by I indices. So, you know, all those indices run over the spatial values, and that's the coordinate component expression to determine where there's a trapped surface. And this is valid not just in spherical symmetry, but in general. If we specialize the spherical symmetry, we have this form for the three-dimensional line element in order to determine what the components of the unit vector SI are. We use the normalization condition. It only has a component in the radial direction, and that component is simply A minus 1. To compute the divergence of that vector, we use the same expression that we used yesterday in writing the wave equation. So that's 1 over root gamma times partial I root gamma times SI upstairs. Okay, the determinant of the three metric is AR squared B squared. Again, I'm forgetting about the angular part that doesn't come into the calculation. And so that term works out to be this, 2RB primed over ARB. Excuse me. And if we substitute in what trace K is, KRR plus 2K theta, and compute what K dotted into SA and SB is, then we find this expression, that RB primed is equal to ARB K theta. So now we can do a little bit of manipulation of that equation to make contact with what I said earlier on. So we go back to the evolution equation for B. It says that B dot is minus alpha B K theta plus beta over R times RB primed. We solve for K theta, multiply by R, and we get this expression. Substituting that back in our previous expression for the position of the apparent horizon, we find that RB dot plus alpha over A minus beta times RB primed is equal to 0. But this is just the outgoing characteristic speed, okay? And R times B is the proper surface area, is the coordinate, this luminosity radius. It's the one that measures proper distance, okay? So what this says is that when you have a marginally trapped surface in spherical symmetry, then the surface of constant aerial radius is outgoing null. Okay, so that's another way of interpreting what it means in order to have a marginally trapped surface. Okay, and I think that's just about it. So thanks for your attention this week, and we'll see you in the lab later on. And I'll be around next week as well to help with the lab and chat with you as need be.